You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Pete Souza spent 8 years as the chief official White House photographer for President Obama and the director of the White House photo office. He documented nearly every key moment of the Obama presidency through candid, revelatory photographs. And these photos have a new life as political commentary on the current administration. For example, on January 27th, just a week after assuming office, President Trump issued an executive order that temporarily denied U.S. entry to citizens of 7 predominantly Muslim nations. In the frenzied days that followed, Souza posted on his Instagram account a picture of former President Obama sharing a laugh with a young Muslim refugee in a classroom. Another example, when President Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch as his pick for the Supreme Court, Pete Souza shared a snapshot of President Obama meeting with Merrick Garland, his nominee for the same seat, who was blocked from even having a hearing. The caption read, "Merrick Garland, just saying." His Instagram account, which has over 2 million followers, Politico described it as a case study in how a former Obama staffer can throw shade at Donald Trump without being too direct. Here to talk politics, pictures, and shade is Pete Souza. His new book is Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. Pete, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let me talk about the job a little bit, and then we'll talk about the book. So
Sure. As
a chief White House photographer, you spend more time with these men than probably anybody else. How do you capture these images, these really intimate images? Are you just there all the time?
I was there as much of the time as I could be. I was always afraid of missing something, which is, you know, to do that every day for 8 years is a little taxing emotionally and physically. But that was, you know, you don't ever know for sure when these candid moments are going to occur. And the only way that you can capture them is if you're there. If you're not there, you're not going to get those pictures.
Now, you were also a photographer under President Ronald Reagan as well. When you're working, did you just try to fade in the background, or are you part of the entourage? You're just part of what happens every day for a president.
I think I'm part of what happens every day, but I also try to fade in the background. I'm not a participant in the room. I'm usually the only person in the room that's not a participant.
So as part of, I know you teach photojournalism, is part of good photojournalism just being very observant?
I think it is being observant and able to anticipate things as they're happening, and also trying to capture the right mood and emotion of what's taking place. So you sort of have to have an understanding of what is happening in front of you, in order to make those kinds of pictures.
And also, I'm assuming you have to be up on all the policies as well to really understand what the moment is.
You have to have a vague notion of the policies. And because that helps you anticipate and helps you capture accurately the mood and the emotion that's taking place.
So what was the last picture you took of the Obama presidency?
Well, depends what you consider last. I mean, I got a picture of him leaving the Oval Office for the last time the morning of January 20th. I got a picture of him with the incoming president at the White House that morning. I got him flying away on the helicopter. I was on the helicopter as we left the Capitol after the Trump inauguration, and he's looking out the window, and we flew by the White House. And then there's another last picture. is of him and Michelle on Air Force One. They let the outgoing president have one last trip on Air Force One, and we flew to Palm Springs, where he and Michelle were going to have a week's vacation. And I flew to Palm Springs with him. And then he got off the plane, and I didn't. I just flew back to D.C. on an almost empty Air Force One.
Oh, my gosh. That's a scene. Somebody should have taken a picture of you.
We were all trying to catch sleep.
I no doubt.
We may have had a cocktail, too, I think.
Okay. You write in your intro of this book, you had seen what the presidency required. So is that why you felt compelled to start posting images in response to the current administration?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a conscious decision at first, but as just those first few days went by, I thought to myself, this man is not capable of being president. He's disrespecting the office already. He's lying already. He lied on the first day just about inauguration crowds. And I was just somewhat appalled by it. And I thought that I could use my voice in a way to just contrast what I had just seen for 8 years with what was taking place in the present day.
So did it feel good to make those first few posts?
I was kind of laughing to myself, actually. I kind of cracked myself up on some of them because I was trying to be somewhat humorous, a little snarky, but not being too disrespectful. And that's sort of changed a little bit over the last 18 months. But I was trying to keep it, you know, fairly light to point out the differences.
One of the most humorous ones, or one of the more humorous ones, is when President Trump tweeted about Kim Jong-un being Little Rocket Man, and your response was?
My response on Instagram was, there's only one Rocket Man, Sir Elton John, and I had a picture of President Obama with Elton John in the Oval Office.
When you first started posting these things on Instagram, what were the initial reactions like?
Oh, the very first post that I made that you would consider shade was a picture of President Obama, either leaning or sitting on the Resolute desk with the red curtains. I had just seen a picture of the redecorated Oval Office with all the gold, and it looked like a palace, not like an Oval Office. And I just said, I think my caption was something like, kind of like the old curtains better. And it was, a slight tongue-in-cheek poke at the new Oval Office, but also at what was happening in the Oval Office. And right away, people picked up on what I was doing. I didn't know if they would, because I was a little, sneaky about it. and somebody that first post used the word shade, that I was throwing shade, and I honestly didn't know what that meant.
Did you go look it up?
I went and looked it up a couple of days later. Because people started writing stories about what I was doing, and I saw that term used in multiple stories, and I go, okay, what does this really mean?
So you wrote, the title of the introduction is Why I Throw Shade. So why? Why do you?
Because, as I said, this is a President Trump who disrespects the office of the presidency. And having worked for both President Reagan and President Obama, let's leave policies aside, as human beings, they were decent people, and they respected the office of the presidency. And I don't see that. I don't see either of those characteristics in the current president.
At one point, did you decide to specifically time your photos and your posts to respond almost in real time to events that are happening?
It kind of depends on what I'm doing on that particular day. If I happen to catch the news in the morning or see one of Trump's tweets early in the morning, then oftentimes I'll post something right away. Then there are other times when I'm busy for a day or two and I'm sort of like posting something that's maybe a little dated. But it's funny because people say to me, they read my post and they write a comment that says, I got to find out what happened in the news because of what I posted. They didn't know what I was referring to. Now, in the book, it becomes very clear what I'm referring to because I'm using his tweets, Trump's tweets, and then also occasionally news headlines and stories. So the connection is very direct in the book, whereas oftentimes on Instagram, I have to make people actually Google what's going on if they haven't been paying attention, to the news that day.
Yeah, a good example is the one I pulled out was from June 26, 2017, when Donald J. Trump tweeted, "The real story is that President Obama did nothing," capitalized, "after being informed in August about Russian meddling." And you posted this picture, which is sort of an iconic picture of Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama looking none too pleased with one another. And you wrote, "On September 5th, 2016, President Obama confronts Vladimir Putin about meddling in our election." Where was this picture taken?
That was taken at a leaders' summit meeting. I believe it was in China. And then they had a sort of a pull-aside meeting one-on-one, Putin and Obama. But like in that case, he's tweeting out something that is false. And those are the ones that really get me irked, I guess, pissed off. And I feel I it's my duty to respond because you can't just let a presidential lie hang out there without responding. And I feel that, you know, I do have a voice now, and I try to use it to counter, you know, his lies and his BS.
Do you consider this, is this a next evolution of photojournalism?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it's going to be difficult for me to get an assignment, you know, from Time Magazine or Newsweek to cover a politician because of, you know, the direction I've taken. But I'm willing to accept that because, to me, first and foremost, I'm a citizen of this country, and I just feel it's my civic duty to speak out, whether or not that hurts me in getting future photo assignments or not is not relevant.
Well, I think that's interesting about that. The reason I ask the question is that's correcting the record. That's not you particularly throwing shade. That's you pointing out an inaccuracy.
But I throw some shade too.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You often use the hashtag throw shade then vote. Do you think that these photos, this post could actually motivate people to vote?
Well, I hope so. I mean, maybe not like, you know, I don't have the kind of power that someone like Taylor Swift has, where, you know, she spoke out and got thousands, tens of thousands of people registered to vote. But I am trying to make the point that it's your civic duty to vote. And I think that if people in Michigan and Wisconsin hadn't stayed home to vote, hadn't stayed home and not mm-hmm. voted, we might not be in the situation we're in now. You never know really which state is going to be the state that's going to turn the election.
We're speaking to Pete Souza about his new book, Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. It's sort of this interesting photojournalism / op-ed, sometimes humorous humorous take on news headlines. For example, you don't only just use tweets, you use headlines. When Roseanne was canceled after Roseanne Barr's racist tweet about Valerie Jarrett, you posted this. I'm going to let you describe the picture and read the caption.
Well, it's a picture of Valerie Jarrett. It was before an event, I think in Pennsylvania, as I recall. And, you know, Valerie Jarrett is one of his closest aides. They've known each other for a long time. She's also close to Michelle. And they're just sitting on these steps, just the two of them, having this casual conversation. And then I wrote, my caption was, "Hi, VJ." That's Valerie's nickname. "Hi, VJ. Bye, Roseanne."
Made you laugh then. Is there anything that you wouldn't throw shade at? I don't think I've seen a picture of Barron.
I will not throw shade at Barron. And I don't think... I think I've actually come to his defense, maybe on Twitter more than on Instagram, where somebody had written a story about Barron, and I just said, you know, he should be off limits. And the press, by and large, left Sasha and Malia alone. And I think that's the way we should react to a child that's in the White House. He didn't get the job. His father did. We should leave the kid alone.
Your book before this, which was a huge bestseller, Obama, An Intimate Portrait. When did you realize that there was a sort of a nostalgia for the Obama presidency? Was it almost immediately, or is it something that has grown as this presidency has established itself for what it is?
You know, the interesting thing about last year was, as I was putting together Obama and Intimate Portrait, which is a documentary photography book of his 8 years. It's a straight documentary book. And I'm putting that book together, but then also I had this side job, which was doing my Instagram feed and doing Shade. So I was doing two separate things at the same time. And it was really from my Instagram feed that I realized how much people really missed President Obama and the Obamas and the way they behaved at the White House. And I could sense that on my Instagram feed.
Did that inform the Intimate Portrait book at all?
Not at all. No. I tried to do an accurate and honest portrayal from my eyes, what I thought was the most important moments, the best photographs, to give people a sense of what it was like for Barack Obama during his 8 years as president, and delve more into some of the little personal moments too that aren't necessarily historical, but tell you a lot about him as a person. Just the way he interacts with kids, the way he interacted with Sasha and Malia, what he was like as a person.
Seems like he really liked kids from your photos.
He did. He liked it. He sort of liked all people. He respected all people.
He struck me as someone who did not suffer fools, however.
He did not suffer fools.
He's too smart a person. His presidency was historic. Did you take that into consideration as you composed photos or you looked for moments that here you have the first African-American presidency? President?
I mean, I think every presidency is historic. The presidency now is historic. Not, you know, we can, I'm not trying to compare the two being equal. But I was aware of that he was the first African-American president. I knew there were moments where he's interacting with young African-American kids, or when he sat on the Rosa Parks bus before an event in Detroit, or those sorts of things. I was definitely trying to keep that in mind as I photographed. But he was also just the president, and in 50 or 100 years, it may not matter that he was the first African-American president, because hopefully there'll be more to come. And so my job was to show him as he was, as a person, as a president, during big events, during small moments.
Do you know the current official White House photographer?
I do. I mean, I say I know her. I've met her.
It's a her. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Do you think that's an easy job or a tough job, having done that job, considering the current president?
One thing I've tried to do is not delve into what my successor is doing, because I don't really know what's taking place behind the scenes. And I feel that I owe her the courtesy of not, critiquing in any way her job. And so I prefer not to answer that question.
What's next for you? What's your next big assignment?
Well, it's going to be a self-assignment. I've got a few projects coming up next year that I can't really divulge yet. It's going to be a couple of fun things.
Considering this took off in a way, that's a good tease. A couple fun things from Pete Souza. There's also an exhibit, I believe it's in New York, is that right?
Yeah, we just had the opening last night. It's 13 giant pictures from the book with the captions as part of the exhibit. And so we had a lot of people come last night, and most of the people actually followed me on Instagram, and they were excited to meet me. I was excited to meet them, and I took solace in the fact that they said I've helped them get through these dark times with my humor and my snarkiness.
This is a really crass question. What if someone wanted to buy one of these photos? Can they buy these photos?
Not anywhere that I know of right now, but eventually all 1.9 million photographs that I took will be available to the public through the National Archives. Like if you were to go to the Reagan Library right now, you could see every picture I ever shot. And you could order a scan or a print or whatever.
But it wouldn't have your good snarkiness underneath it, though.
No, well, you can't.
But you can get the book.
You can order the prints from the gallery show at the Stephen Kasher Gallery.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
The name of the book is Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents by Pete Souza. His exhibit, Throw Shade, Then Vote, is open now through December 8th at the Stephen Kasher Gallery in New York. Pete, thanks so much for being with us on all of it.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Allison Stewart, and this is All of It. The Emmy Award-winning actor Brian Cox is currently ripping it up on HBO, playing a media titan with a family drama, including backstabbing, double timing, and duplicitous children. It's so very Shakespearean, which suits Brian Cox well. He played Brutus in the 1977 London National Theatre production of Julius Caesar, Macbeth in a production that toured India, as well as Titus Andronicus in the Royal Shakespeare Company, for which he earned an Olivier Award. Now he is back in the world of the Bard for the third season of Shakespeare Uncovered on PBS, examining how the story in Julius Caesar is as relevant today as it was when it was first performed. The Julius Caesar episode of Shakespeare Uncovered premieres Friday, October 19th at 10 p.m. on PBS and is streaming on pbs.org the next day. And Brian, welcome to All of It.
Hi.
This is like my English.
Good afternoon, Robert.
This is my English literature major's dream to talk about this. You played Brutus in 1977. You said it's an extremely difficult part to play, or complex part.
It's difficult because it's in many ways it's a very modern part, and it actually gets, you know, I think it's not theatrical. There are other theatrical characters in the play, Cassius being emotional, Mark Antony being quite obviously theatrical, and Julius Caesar himself. But Brutus is this kind of still center at the in the middle of that play, and it was a very hard part to play because, in a way, it's a bit like a three-legged race. You don't quite know who the central figure is in the play. But clearly, from Shakespeare's point of view, and also from the point of view of when he wrote the play, it is Brutus. But in a way, it's not got the kind of usual theatric dynamics attached to it. So actually, it's a play which becomes more and more relevant as time goes on. And also, we read it much clearer mm-hmm. now than we did in the past. Because everybody knows about Mark Antony, but, you know, Mark Antony's a liar, basically, and he's a sort of pretty boy who, you know, does a great turn. But the centrifugal force is Brutus, and the debate on what true leadership is about, and where what becomes demagogic, what becomes tyrannical, what becomes dictatorial. And these are elements which are so strong now in our culture and what's happening both on this side of the Atlantic and on the other side of the Atlantic as well, with the poisoner of Moscow, who's been pretty active of late, doing things which are completely untenable. So I think the play is more relevant now than it ever was.
As I was watching the Uncovered episode, it was so interesting to see Julius Caesar, the different applications in the different countries and then the different stagings of it.
Yeah.
Did you realize it was as pliable a play?
Oh, well, I think it's pliable because the central theme is so universal,
yeah.
You know, about man's responsibility to his society and how you honor that society. And I think that goes with any country, anywhere in the world, you know, and I think that these are the issues of the play that so still resonate. I mean, the play was written at the time when there was severe doubt about who was going to be. It was written at the time of, quite late into Queen Elizabeth's reign. And she was not long. I mean, she was going to be dead within 3 or 4 years. And there still wasn't an heir. So there was a great deal of uncertainty, particular political uncertainty that was happening in England at that time. And Shakespeare really sort of caught the zeitgeist of it and wrote this play, which I don't think at the time, though he's a pretty clever writer, extends, you know, kind of beyond time.
Well, it's also interesting we think about now, this is something I study in college or in some students study in high school, but Shakespeare plays, people, they were popular.
Yeah.
They were the popular entertainment of the time,
they
and
were,
so
indeed.
They were on those themes.
And it's also ironic that Julius Caesar, there was a production of Julius Caesar in 1864, in which the Booth brothers took part. You had Junius Booth, who played Cassius. You had Edwin Booth, who played Brutus. And you had John Wilkes Booth, who played Mark Antony. Now, within a year of that production, John Wilkes Booth will have assassinated Abraham Lincoln at a theater in the middle of a performance. And not only that, that play, subsequent to Lincoln's assassination, became one of the most popular plays, Shakespeare plays of its time. It lasted for about 15 years as the most popular Shakespeare play. So it's quite interesting, the sort of how one event leads to the other, mm-hmm. and how a play achieves a kind of notoriety.
And Booth was assisted by some fellow actors.
Yeah.
His escape.
Yeah, exactly.
Out the back.
Well, I've often thought that Booth, in a way, is a bit. He was sort of led to doing what he did, a kind of theatrical thing. I mean, the whole assassination was so theatrical, and the fact that he broke his ankle diving off
out of the box
yeah. in the Ford Theater and running. I mean, it was a kind of. It was like a soap opera, really.
In the show also, of course, you mentioned something that New Yorkers all remember, when Julius Caesar was being staged in the park.
Yeah.
And you spoke to the actor Greg Henry.
Yeah.
About his version of Julius Caesar, who was very much Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And the way that the crowd reacted.
Yeah.
What did he have to say?
Well, I think it was a decision that was made at the time. I mean, my feeling is that Julius Caesar is very unlike Donald Trump. And I think it's, time and situation kind of allies in a certain way, and we look for kind of parallels. And they try to make a parallel out of that, but I'm not totally convinced that there is a proper parallel between Donald Trump and Julius Caesar. I think Julius Caesar was far more intelligent than Donald Trump. And he was a sort of, in many ways, he was cannier, and he kind of knew how to play it. And also Well, I suppose that's Trumpian, like, this is my time, this is my moment, and I will seize the moment, seize the day, carpe diem. So that's similar.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting about the show, it's called Shakespeare Uncovered, by the way, is the introduction of historians who come in, or people, for example, Ben Rhodes, who was a speechwriter. That's
right.
Just such an interesting texture to add, to ask him about how to deliver
that's
an address.
Right. Yeah, and of course, that is the most classical address of all time, which is Antony's address to the... And that's why the play, in a way, the balance of the play is very hard, because when Antony comes on and does his shtick, and it is a shtick, everybody buys into it. And, of course, it shows the power of the mob, and it shows how the mob really... And this is particularly exemplified in the fascist production that Orson Welles did in the 30s, when Norman Lloyd, who's still with us, aged 102, and he played Cinna the Poet. And there's that great confusion about, is it Cinna the Conspirator or Cinna the Poet? But then from the mob's point of view, it doesn't matter. Just let's kill him for his bad verses. And that's kind of chilling. And that actually, when that was done in New York, here in this town, mm-hmm. it stopped the performance. The sheer horror of this poet being mistaken as a conspirator, and also that phrase, then kill him for his bad verses. I mean, it's kind of scary, really scary. And I think that Shakespeare is such a genius writer that he could anticipate anything, really.
Could he have anticipated the family in Succession?
Well, there's family. Well, the family in Succession are there's lots of elements of Lear in Succession.
Terrible children.
And there's treacherous children, and there's also this thing that comes in Shakespeare's plays a lot, is the notion of entitlement. The notion of, you see in Richard III, you see these families that have believed that they are the bee's knees, and they are entitled to behave in a way that is almost criminal. And that happens again and again in Shakespeare. I mean, the War of the Roses is full of these kind of, these children that behave in this kind of way, So we haven't traveled very far, really.
If for folks who haven't seen Succession, and you can watch it, you should binge it. It's great. It's about a media mogul, a titan. He's the patriarch. He's the lion of his family and of the industry, but he has these power-hungry, sort of morally fluid children. But you have said about him, his name is Logan Roy. Logan is, I don't see Logan as a bad man. I see him as a man of the times.
Well, very much so.
How yeah. so?
Well, I think we live in very dubious times. I think we live in times when morality has become low-graded. You know, we don't stand up for things in a way. I mean, the fact that, you know, well, I don't want to go into details about what's going on in this country, but certainly in terms of ambition related to truth, you know, there's a sort of big gap between them. And every day in the news, we're getting examples of, the killing of this extraordinary, brave and tragic figure in Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, killed in the embassy, and what's going on, and the fact that we're trying to disavow that. And needs must. We live in such a needs must culture, so that we're so... blind to what is so obvious, you know, the emperor's new clothes, you know, he's naked. That's it. There's a sort of naked ambition, horror, you know, and of course, Logan Roy understands that. He has the sense to realize that that's what people do. People behave and they jump on a particular bandwagon because they're persuaded to do it. Like the mob in Julius Caesar. The mob in Julius Caesar says it doesn't matter.
Yes.
It doesn't matter that he's not Cinna the conspirator. Let's kill him for his bad verses. And probably none of them have read his verses. But that's just an assumption that is made. And it's a kind of viciousness. And it's very prevalent now. Very prevalent in our society.
Before I let you go, I have to say, someone tweeted us knowing you were going to be on the show, and she said, I have a silly request given the breadth of work and depth of talent. Can you please give him our sincere thanks for the McLeavy audio dramas, which are weekly listening in our house? Any McLeavy plans for the future?
No McLeavy plans, sadly, for the future. We have an idea of taking McLeavy to San Francisco for the gold rush, so the BBC is still working on that.
All right, Katie, that one was for you. Brian Cox, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The third episode of Shakespeare Uncovered, Julius Caesar, will air this Friday, October 19th at 10 p.m. This is All of It.